Hughes, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Eleanor Power, a recently minted PhD in anthropology from Stanford University and currently a postdoctoral fellow at the Santa Fe Institute in none other than Santa Fe, New Mexico. Eleanor specializes in the study of religious belief, practice, and identity, and how all that interacts with and shapes interpersonal relationships, with a particular focus on the interaction between costly signaling and cooperation, gender differences in prestige and social status, and the dynamics of gossip and social censure. She is the author of a recent working paper entitled Faith in the Faithful, Social Support Networks and Religiosity in Rural South India, that she presented at a recent workshop sponsored by the Institute for the Study of Religion, Economics, and Society at Chapman University, as well as a few other venues, including my old stomping grounds of UCLA. Fight, fight, fight. The presentation at IRIS was awesome, and that topic so intriguing that I had to ask Dr. Power to be on the show. She rose to the top of my guest list, and it's a great opportunity to actually hear and see her at this event. So for graduate students and recent PhDs who study religion, you should get in touch with the good folks over at IRIS, as they have an annual graduate workshop that you can participate in, and I am oftentimes there mentoring those graduate students. So if you want to meet me, that's great. We'll put up links to Ellie's website, all her works, as well as the Institute for the Study of Religion, Economics, and Society, so you can all check that out. Ellie, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Let's start off with a little bit about where you're located right now, because many of my guests come from universities, and those are pretty easy to figure out where they are, be it University of Michigan or what have you. But this Santa Fe Institute, that's a little bit different. I don't know much about that. So what is it, and how did you end up there?
Yeah, it is a funny little place. So it was started in, I think, 1984, primarily by scientists who had been at Los Alamos National Labs, which is about an hour away from Santa Fe. And these scientists, including some Nobel Prize winners, were fed up with the sort of siloing of different bodies of expertise, different disciplines into, you know, in their own little world of jargon and, sort of infighting. So before interdisciplinarity was a thing, they wanted to create a place where they could actually do that. Actually, you know, all these physicists wanted to ask questions of society and, biology and the rest. So they created Santa Fe Institute to be that place that, you know, where you could really have proper interdisciplinary work. So that means that my colleagues here are physicists, mathematicians, theoretical biologists, economists, sort of any discipline that covers the full ranges. The sort of unifying thread is complexity theory and a study of complex adaptive systems. So the idea is basically that there are sort of common threads and sort of systems that work whether you're looking at, you know, a cellular system, a whole ecosystem, a transportation network, or, a social system and social network. And that if we can sort of discern what those underlying, processes are that hold across these very disparate systems, we can really say something fundamental about the workings of the world. So I ended up here because I, in part, look at social networks and ask questions about the sort of the ways in which individual behavior can ratchet up to collective forms. So I very, very grateful, very gratefully, I was given a postdoctoral fellowship here. It's called the Omidyar Fellowship, which is funded by Pierre Omidyar, the eBay guy. It's a postdoc here that others who are interested in any form of complexity are certainly welcome to apply for. Santa Fe Institute is a pretty interesting place. It's got a really nice mix of people who are just generally curious. I think that's sort of the unifying factor. There's a summer school that graduate students are always interested in, so they can look out for that. And then there are online courses as well, and this postdoc position that I have. There are about 15 postdocs here, 15 resident faculty, and then something like 100 external faculty. So it's a nice mix of people coming through with interesting and sometimes strange ideas.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. You got all those physicists and stuff around. Do they walk around the halls talking about Star Trek conventions? Why, you can't wait to see the new Star Wars film.
You know, there is a little bit of that. That. They cannot be less. Well, they're certainly dorky, but they're lovely dorks.
Okay, lovely dorks. We like that kind of stuff in academia. So, yeah, we'll put a link to that. Your biography will also be linked up there as well. And Oh, interest in your biography as well, too. The paper that we'll be discussing today, which I think is a distillation of some of your dissertation work, is about religious rituals, and specifically rituals that may seem a bit odd or irrational, especially to us Westerners. But you're an anthropologist, and I think the first anthropologist that we've had on this program in nearly 300 shows, so congratulations on that. But how did you stumble across the idea of studying rituals? I guess that is kind of an anthropology thing. You think like a sociologist to have Durkheim and other folks like that. So how did you come about to study this topic?
So before I was really an anthropologist, I was an archaeologist. All throughout undergrad, I studied archaeology. Of course, technically archaeology is a sub-discipline of anthropology, but be that what it is. So when I was studying archaeology, I was really interested in understanding these sort of critical transitions in early human history. So transition to sedentary living, to, towns, and then eventually city-states, complex state societies. How did these big shifts that we now sort of take for granted as the way society works come about? And often in those discussions, whether you're talking about, the Fertile Crescent or the Mayan civilizations or wherever, religion is often brought into these discussions. And in the archaeological record, you're looking for evidence, you're looking for evidence of ritual behavior, of religion, of the belief in the divine in some sort. But it was always hard to really, say something with a lot of confidence when you're drawing from the archaeological record, just because, the fundamental process there means you've got a very meager source of evidence. People can do some amazing work with it, but I always wanted to be able to say something a bit more concrete than what the archaeological record allows. So I shifted over to anthropology then so that I could actually, deal with contemporary people who can still sort of inform us of, these general processes of social living, of belief, that are going to have relevance for our understanding of human sociality and the social evolution of our species over time.
Yeah, so you do bring it up to contemporary periods of time. It's much different from in archaeology. We always think of Indiana Jones digging bones and finding crystal skulls and stuff.
I did dig in Petra, where he found the Holy Grail.
So, oh, you did?
I had a good background there.
Oh, that is so cool. Do you have like one of those hats too?
If only. Now I could probably pull that off in Santa Fe, but I'll work on it. Next time I see you, I'll be a person.
I'm just pulling out all my stereotypes, archaeologists and anthropologists here. But you're now up doing stuff in contemporary times, and most of your research takes place in India, and specifically in two villages in the southern part of the country that are populated by both Hindus and Christians. We'll talk a little bit more specifically about those villages here in a second, but what drove you to, first of all, choose India as a place to study? Was it the question led you there, or, for me, I decided to start studying Latin America because the language was easier and I enjoyed the food. Those are little secrets of how we choose our topics. Why India?
Right. So, you already mentioned Durkheim. We draw on him in anthropology as well. And if you he has this fundamental idea of how, religion is really a fundamental force driving the creation of the social being, of society, all of these fundamental things, which is really a very common idea that, through collective worship, through religious belief, you get this sort of emergence of community, of really the social group. I mean, if you look at Durkheim's definition of religion, he says that it's, you know, belief and practices that unite us into a single moral community. And that single moral community, sometimes community there, is actually translated into English as congregation. And there's a lot of work that's done trying to understand religion generally that ends up speaking about congregations, that sort of by default takes a Judeo-Christian or more generally Abrahamic view of what religion is. You know, where people come together every Sunday or every Friday, they, you know, worship together, they have a moral lesson taught to them by a religious leader, and not surprisingly, then you get this sort of idea of a community coming out of that. But that is not the only way in which religion happens in the world. There are many diverse ways and experiences of religious belief and practice. And so if we want to be talking about what religion does in society generally, we need to have a much wider frame than just maybe what we are most used to in the West, right? And if we want to be talking about the emergence of a religious community, if you're working in a place where there is already a congregation, where people are card-carrying members, they say, I am a member of the Episcopalian Church, I am a member of this, you know, this mosque, this synagogue, you can't separate those two, right? You can't actually look at the emergence of community among members when that group exists a priori. So Hinduism provides us a nice contrast. It's a very different type of religious experience. It's a very different type of religious worship. And there isn't this idea in the Hindu setting of a congregation to speak of. So whereas you might, church has you going together, worshiping together each Sunday, singing together the rest. In Hinduism, you know, usually people go to a temple on a Tuesday or a Friday, but they can go whenever they want. They're going usually individually. There will probably be a priest there, but that priest is not there imparting advice about how to live your life. That priest is just there to facilitate your direct interaction with the god. So the fundamental thing when you worship in Hinduism is taking darshan, which is the sort of mutual viewing. So you are seeing the god and the god is seeing you. And there's a direct exchange there. That's not mediated by any collective experience. It doesn't have you getting a sort of ethical code, you know, jammed in your face at that moment. So it's a very different type of religious worship that gives us a very good contrast to what we might otherwise be thinking of. And so if we find then similar patterns or comparable patterns or something very different when you're working with Hinduism, as you do in all of the work that's been done, the social scientific work that's been done on religion in more Abrahamic settings, then we're really going to be able to say something much broader about what religion is and what it does. So India provided a good place for me to work because we've got the case of Hinduism there, but it's also actually a pluralistic religious setting. So in the villages that I work in, there are also Catholics and Protestants. So I can sort of compare across those religious denominations and see if we see something different about the structure of relationships between individuals, given the distinction in the nature of their worship and belief.
Very good. Had you been to India before, or was this just a really great research setting? We got a non-Western religion, Hinduism, we got Christianity, seems like a great comparison. I'm going to head on out, and hello, India.
So it was a little bit of both. So when I started my PhD, I didn't know where I wanted to work. I actually went with some biologists to an island in the South Pacific, in the island nation of Kiribati, to see if that could be a good place to work. Of course, it turned out that they actually had all been the subject of intense missionary work. So there were Catholics and Protestants there, and they even had religious wars between the Catholics and Protestants, and not about the place to work. So India was some place that I had been thinking of before, and in part because I had been there before. I have a twin brother, and he happened to have studied abroad in South India when he was in college, and I had gone out to visit him. So he knew a few people that, you know, local scholars and academics that he could put me in touch with. So it was a sort of easy place that I knew it would line up well with the questions that I wanted to ask, and I knew a few people to get me on the ground. And hey, like you said, the food isn't bad either. So.
Yeah, all that stuff. Yeah. Yeah. All that stuff tends to come together, which is kind of neat. We oftentimes choose our or case studies according to what the research design is, but there are all these little fortuitous things. You're like, your brother was there before, or, you know, I really like the food and I know the language, et cetera, et cetera. So,
God, I wish I happened to have grown up speaking Tamil. Tamil is a hard language. It's, you know, it's one of the fastest languages in terms of syllables per second. So that took me a bit to work up on. But yeah, I mean, it was a nice place to go, and once I got there and started, you know, sort of traveling around and talking with people, it became very apparent that it was going to be a good place to work. The two villages that I happened to end up in it was totally happenstance, really. I sort of knew someone who, you know, who could introduce me there. They're pretty typical villages. They're not too remarkable one way or another.
Well, we'll talk about those here in a second when we start talking about the actual research, the case studies that you choose, and your research design. But let's talk about the issue of rituals, right? That's where you focus on, or at least the presentation that I saw at IRIS, you focused on rituals. What do you mean by rituals? What are we talking about here?
Well, you just hit upon one of those, you know, this is one of those terms that you can find hundreds and hundreds of definitions for, and it really is, I think anthropologists have resolved themselves to treating it as a somewhat vague category, sort of like culture. You know it when you see it, sort of thing. But generally definitions of ritual are that it's sort of a scripted, often sort of stereotyped form of action. Often it's collective, so this would differ from how psychologists might define ritual. And it typically has some sort of symbolic meaning. So there's more going on than just the actions that you're carrying out. So, of course, rituals do not necessarily have to be religious, but I'm certainly talking about religious rituals here. But, I mean, a more general term to cover the full range of what I'm looking at might just be sort of religious action, behavior that's oriented towards the divine in one way or another.
Yeah, and then the important aspect of this, too, you mentioned public out there. I think of rituals too. You could have individual rituals, you know, ritual of getting up and doing your yoga in the morning or something. But the public aspect becomes important for you, correct?
Yeah, definitely. So that's one of the crucial features here, because what I'm trying to look at in my work is trying to understand sort of what people manage to pull, what information can you draw to help you make your decisions about your life from the actions that you observe of your peers. So I really am focusing on public ritual practice. You're totally right. Of course, there's many forms of religious rituals that are often private. So, you know, praying each night, you know, sort of personalized worship at you know, within the home. Certainly within a Hindu setting, that happens very often. Most families have a small sort of shrine in their home that they might, stop by each morning, that sort of thing. But I'm really, yes, completely focusing on public ritual action, and really often sort of collective acts where you've got multiple people carrying things out together and onlookers as well who are to some degree or not involved.
Now, at the presentation that you gave, which was an excellent presentation, really good use of PowerPoint, very visual, you showed some of these rituals, and you zero in on a number of these that just seem to our eyes in the West as being kind of odd, and even to any, you know, what you'd consider a rational person to be somewhat irrational. Go ahead and give us a flavor for some of the ritual practices that you focus on in your research out there in India.
Sure, yeah. So the most dramatic and eye-catching religious action that I study is, you know, impressive things like fire walking, so people walking across a bed of hot coal, and more impressive still, people piercing their bodies with hooks and spears. So taking a spear that's about, you know, 10 feet long, maybe the diameter of your pinky finger, maybe a little bit less than that, and having that pushed through your cheek. And then, yeah, and then, or the nape of your neck, and then you'll go through a procession with the spear through your body. Okay, so there are other sorts of rituals or religious action that other people also carry out. So there's people who carry fire pots in processions. So it's a clay pot that has a flame coming out of it. People roll prostrated around a temple, so they'll circumnavigate or circumscribe the temple usually three times. So the ones I've mentioned so far have all been Hindu acts that are typically carried out, but this isn't limited to those communities as well. So Catholics and Hindus as well often go on pilgrimages for the Hindus nearby sort of regional temples, and for the Catholics, some of these bigger churches where miracles have said to take place, sort of prominent churches and cathedrals. Catholics also often do animal sacrifice, so they'll sacrifice a goat. They'll also get their hair tonsured like Hindus will, so they'll get their head shaved. Now, a lot of these acts are actually being done as a form of vow fulfillment. So let's say that you really, want some assistance in some part of your life. You really want a new job. You really want to have a child. You'll pray to the god and request assistance in, whatever you need, and promise at that moment when you're making the request that if the god comes through for you, again, this can be the Christian god as well, if the god comes through for you, you promise to do some act out of gratitude and thanks for the sort of demonstration of the power and generosity of the gods. So then when someone's piercing their bodies with spears or firewalking or going on a pilgrimage or getting their hair tonsured, that's usually evidence that as promised, as requested, the god has come to their aid and people are fulfilling what they had promised to do at that time. In all of these settings as well, there's both that intense focus and sort of investment in the moment itself, but there's usually a long period of fasting that precedes that, sometimes for upwards of a month, where people will be denying themselves many, many things. So obviously, primary one is no sex, usually no, maybe only one big meal during the day, so fasting food-wise for the rest of the day, no meat, no drinking, no alcohol. You usually can't cut your hair or your toenails and fingernails, so guys always end up with a nice beard and looking very scruffy. You've got to bathe two times a day. You have to go to the church or the temple two times a day. You have to be nice to other people, a series of prescriptions that curtail people's behavior to sort of prepare them to make them worthy of the task that they've set themselves. So all of these acts, regardless of the community that you're part of, are usually pretty intense investments of time and energy, often money. You have to pay for these things as well. If you're going to go on pilgrimage, you've got to pay for all the food along the way and for where you're going to be staying, and can entail serious bodily risk. So, for example, two people have fallen while going across the bed of hot coals and had really severe burns as they've been firewalking. So a range of intense acts that people are carrying out in the name of the divine, both for Christians and Protestants here.
Yeah, I remember you showing the pictures of this during your presentation. You showed the ones of the piercing, which kind of got to me because I'm not a big fan of sharp objects. You could have shown the firewalking. I think that I can handle. But it is unusual. I mean, I think we've all seen this through National Geographic television specials or, on the internet or something like that. But for you, going there and seeing this stuff for the first time, and I assume that you actually observed a number of these folks doing these things. Mm-hmm. Was it really different seeing it in person or live?
Yeah, so there is some element of that. I mean, these are impressive to see. That's undeniable. All of that being said, as an anthropologist, what I'm constantly trying to do is sort of place myself in the, from the perspective of a local person there. So I'm constantly sort of gauging my reaction to things based on the reactions that I see other people having around me. So, for people who have been going to temples and churches for all of their lives and seeing acts like this for all of their lives, I mean, people are impressed, but it's also just sort of like, oh, yeah, some more firewalking. Oh, yeah, you're getting some hooks through the skin there. That's what you do. The strongest example of this is possession, which is another thing that happens particularly among the Hindu community here. And it's a really intense thing where, sort of the energy of the god is suddenly coursing through someone's body. And the reaction half the time for, you know, the people next to that possessed person is, oh, God, you know, here's this possessed person flailing around. They're going to hit me in the face. Now I've got to deal with that.
Yeah.
So it's easy to be impressed, and certainly people are, but it's also like, you know, this is what people do, and you know, people sort of react accordingly. So had I been there, you know, not surrounded by, you know, hundreds of other people at some of these big festivals, maybe my jaw would have been a little bit closer to the floor. But, you know, as an anthropologist, I was duly closing my jaw to, you know, to react. I mean, what's also interesting, too, of, you know, I spent 2 years living in these villages, so I know the people who are carrying them out. So, you know, watching that transformation in people who I see on a daily basis and know and talk with, is maybe the most impressive part of it. Just that we're, you know, any individual is capable of these acts if they, you know, desire to do so. So that is maybe the most impressive.
That's really great that you're reflective about your position in the environment as a researcher as well. I think anthropologists are a little bit more sensitive to that than other fields, but it is something that, as social scientists, we have to understand that when we become part of the process. It affects us in a lot of different ways and can affect the scene. One of the things that you mentioned is that these rituals are very costly, as you mentioned, in terms of money, but in terms of time, the sacrifice of giving up sex and food and drink, as well as just the physical pain, right? That's just, for us, it seems irrational. And this is what draws our interest to it, I think. And it's drawn the interest of a lot of social scientists over time to explain why would anybody do this. I mean, most faculty members at Western universities don't do this, so why would anybody else do this? What are some of the explanations for why people have engaged in this? I know you have your own explanations, but how have other folks thought about this before?
Right. So, I mean, I think the sort of lay explanation, and one that a lot of people hold to, and one that's, I don't know, even within the scholarship, is, you know, this is inexplicable. This is irrational. These people are just crazy. You know, they're deluded in some way by their belief that they, you know, this is some backwards old tradition that, you know, people just haven't sort of stepped up and out of yet. Of course, you know, as you well know, that's certainly not the perspective that I take. Even seeing these acts that I'm talking about as sort of timeless, ancient rituals that still continue today is actually totally wrong. In this setting, the rituals that I'm primarily looking at were introduced to these villages about 15 years ago by people who are specifically emulating what they saw happening at bigger temples in cities nearby. So they'll actually use the English word "developed" to talk about the introduction of these acts into the festival there. They want to develop their village. They want to sort of modernize it, make it a sort of a regional center and destination by bringing in these rituals. So rather than these sort of timeless old things that we can explain away by saying, oh, that's just how people used to do it in the past, actually what's happening here is a sort of active dynamic process and sort of evolution of these behaviors as people seek to sort of live a richer religious life. So, you know, that's one point to say. But, I mean, yes, the typical explanation is that these are sort of irrational acts carried out by people who, you know, have been somehow convinced of this set of beliefs. And that even holds for some other explanations in anthropology, where they focus, when they're looking at religion, more on the salience of religious belief rather than religious action. So the ways in which these can be a sort of emotional solve for people, you know, bringing individuals together. Victor Turner and other, you know, other anthropologists see these intense, often dysphoric, meaning painful, ritual acts as being important ways, sort of rites of passage in which people are brought together, sort of given a social category and position through their performance of these acts, and the rest. There are lots of explanations. I think one thing I would say, though, is while these are obviously eye-catching acts that sort of raise our eyebrows, there are certainly things that people do in Judeo-Christian Abrahamic religions that also, you know, you can see as sort of costly and in some sense inexplicable. So questions of tithing, also fall into this category, right? Why are people donating so much money? There are plenty of examples within other religions. I mean, it's sort of a common feature of religion generally that when you have these actions oriented towards the divine, if you take a sort of narrow, rational, accurate framework, a lot of it becomes sort of inexplicable until you really put it in its wider social context.
Yeah, and I think from the outsider perspective, too, it's what makes it eye-popping because, I think about Catholics and Ash Wednesday where they're putting a black mark on their forehead. And for me, growing up Catholic, I go, everybody does that. That's not that big a deal. But from somebody from the outside looks at that and said, what are you doing that for? Why are you, marking up a perfectly good forehead there? So it's that kind of aspect that comes in. Okay, so it seems irrational. Many people would look at it that way, and other people have talked about the salience of religious beliefs. What do you bring to the table in terms of explaining this seemingly inexplicable behavior?
Yeah, so I'm joining a sort of wider body of literature that specifically applies signaling theory to explain some of these behaviors. So signaling theory is a body of work that was actually hit upon simultaneously in a number of different disciplines that are generally explaining acts that, again, if you come from a sort of narrow rational actor perspective, seem to some degree inexplicable. We humans are always doing things that seem inexplicable or irrational. We're always, helping people when it would be better just to be selfish. We're sharing food with other people. We're, constantly doing these acts that don't seem to fit. And that doesn't just hold for humans, that holds for all sorts of animals as well. So signaling theory was hit upon in a number of fields to try to explain this just sort of plethora of situations in which humans and animals seem to be doing something funny. So in economics, it was Spence and Akerlof who were trying to explain things like, car markets and higher education, so relevant for a lot of the listeners here probably. In sociology, Veblen had his theory of conspicuous consumption, which sort of fits into the same framework. And in biology, there was Zahavi, who was talking about handicap principle and, why does the peacock have this huge tail? And it was formalized by Graffin. So all of these disparate fields were trying to explain these often sort of extravagant, often costly acts that individuals carry out. And the explanation that's usually given across these different fields is that there's something that's being communicated through these acts. But generally, the process of communication is an extremely hard one. How can I ever know that a person isn't lying to me? Talk is cheap, right? I could be making all of this up right now, Tony, and you would have no way to really validate it, except if I sort of back it up in some convincing way. And one convincing way to back up those actions is to have that process of communication, that act of communication, be something that entails a cost, so that only those individuals who truly have the quality, who truly have the sort of belief, are able to carry it out in the first place. So it becomes a way to discriminate between those people who are sort of honestly communicating something there, and those individuals who are unable to make that communicative act because they do not have the underlying quality. So Richard Sosis is an anthropologist at the University of Connecticut. He was one of the first people to introduce signaling theory to the study of religion and used it specifically to explain those aspects of religion that seem to be the most costly. So things like the rituals that I'm studying, but also processes of tithing, of sort of restrictions that are placed upon members of a religious community. And the general idea, again, here is going to be that only those individuals who truly believe, who are actually really committed to the moral precepts of the community, who really believe in that higher power and what that higher power stands for, are going to be willing and even able to carry out these sorts of actions that are demanded of religious members. So that when you see someone walking across a bed of hot coals or tithing 10% of their annual income, you can have some confidence about who that person is. about certainly their religiosity, the depth of their devotion, but more generally about their adherence to the moral values of that community. And so something about their character, about their trustworthiness, about their pro-sociality. You know, this is not going to be someone who's going to cheat you. If they truly believe, that person, you can have a lot more confidence in. So because we can have more confidence than in the sort of these acts of communication, individuals then should be able to establish these trusting relationships that can be mutually beneficial. You can establish cooperation. You can overcome all of those things that make cooperation hard, right? You don't have to worry about selfish individuals who are going to cheat you. You don't have to worry about collective action problems. You can overcome all of those things, and the idea is you'll be able to create this sort of cohesive, cooperative religious communities that's able to withstand free riders, that's able to overcome collective action problems. So that was the explanation that was proffered for one of the reasons that we have, that religion seems to consistently have across these different settings, these acts and these restrictions that are demanded of adherents, and that these acts help individuals convey something about themselves, help other individuals discern that information, help them then establish these cooperative relationships that are going to result in that cohesive community. So it's in part through these actions that we get the religious community that we're maybe so familiar with.
Yeah.
So that has essentially been established now as a theory of what religion does and the role of religious rituals and practices in all of that. So what I've tried to do is test out those claims in these two villages in South India, where we have this range of religious action, a setting in which relationships between individuals really are crucial to people's livelihood. So these are relationships that matter. They're really consequential. And then we can see, really, if we do find that religion seems to serve these purposes for individuals and for the groups that they're a part of.
Yeah, I think this stuff on signaling is absolutely fascinating, and I teach a lot of this in my political economy class, and your work is really building on that. What is more interesting about your work is that not only are you looking at the signals being sent and the functions that they might serve, but also whether people understand the signal, right? Communications is a two-way street. So, yeah, I'm trying to signal this, that, or the other thing by walking across coals or piercing my cheek, but if the other person on the other side doesn't understand what that is, I'm just getting burnt soles and holes in my face. You know?
Exactly. So yeah. It's really, at this point, it has largely been a hypothesis that religious individuals, those individuals who are carrying out these sorts of costly acts and the rest, are more cooperative, more trustworthy in the rest. And there have been some really good studies that have evaluated how cooperative those individuals might be, and have found that generally, yes, actually. The results have been somewhat mixed, but at least in the more sort of ethnographic examinations, quantitative ethnographic examinations, yes, those people who are more involved in the religious life of the village are actually more cooperative, more generous when playing economic games than the rest. Mm-hmm. But it's still a question then as to whether or not other people perceive that. So mm-hmm. as a first step, I wanted to see, okay, we have this idea that those individuals are going to be more trustworthy, more pro-social. Do other individuals, do the people who are observing those individuals' actions actually discern that? Are they pulling the same information from it that we expect them to?
So tell us about your study. How did you go about finding this out? Give us a little idea of the case studies and your research design and then the results.
Sure. So, like I said, as a good anthropologist, I spent 2 years living in these two villages. So it was 1 year living in one village and 1 year in the next. I lived with a family in each village. I was, there all the time. I mostly filled up my time just bothering people with silly questions and, sitting around and gossiping with people, sort of trying to, insert myself into regular daily life there as a good anthropologist. As a good anthropologist does. I did ethnography, right? But then I also did some more formal, sort of data collection work as well. So I got information on people's religious practice, all of the residents of these two villages. So they each have about maybe, you know, 300 or 400 adult residents in these two villages. So I got information for all of the adults as to what religious action they carried out over the course of the year. So, you know, for any one individual, okay, did they, in the past year, you know, had they gone to visit, you know, one temple and made a small offering there, maybe at another temple they went to the festival and, you know, carried a fire pot in a procession. At another, you know, the festival in the village, they might have carried a pot of milk in an act of worship. So I have information on the public ritual action, the public religious action that all of the adult residents carried out for Hindus, Protestants, and Catholics. Then I have information on who does a more sort of consistent, in some sense subtle, but certainly more regular act of just each week going to a church or a temple to give me a sense of the sort of more mundane religious action that still is very observable here. These are small villages, so people know who are those individuals who go to church each week and who go to the temple each week. And then I also have information on who gets possessed on a somewhat regular basis, but only a few individuals, only Hindus. But it's just this very evocative sort of religious action. So I tried to get information basically on all of the sorts of religious action that would be public knowledge, that would be observable by anyone in the village. So that gave me a record of the sort of intensity of people's religious action over the course of a year. And of course, I would go, if anybody was going on a pilgrimage, I would go with them. You know, so I would sort of experience these actions. If people were going to festivals, I would often accompany them to those as well. And obviously, anything that was happening in the village itself, I was always there for to see what was happening. So that gave me a sense of people's religious standing. Then I did a survey with all of the almost 800 adult residents in the two villages, and that had two parts. So first, I asked people a series of questions about the reputational standing of their peers. So who in the village do you think is especially hardworking? Who do you think is very devout? Who do you think is very influential? A series of different questions getting at sort of desirable qualities that individuals might have that could give them, in some sense, sort of repute. And people would just give me names, and I knew who all those people were. So I could end up getting a sort of measure of each individual's reputational standing in the village across these different qualities. And then I did a social support network survey. So this is sort of standard form. The canonical question is, who do you discuss important matters with? And again, people would just list the names of those individuals that they went to for that. But of course, there are many different types of support. So I asked a series of questions about, you know, sort of emotional support and companionship, behavioral assistance, you know, who do you have run errands for you? But then also, you know, who would you borrow, you know, bus change from? Who do you just enjoy spending time talking with? So behavioral assistance, financial support, including, you know, sizable loans. Who do you go to for advice and guidance? And then let's say, you know, you need someone to vouch for you. Let's say you want to find more work. Who would you go to for help finding work? Who comes to your aid if there's some problem? Who do you know, you know, it's a doctor or a lawyer? So it's trying to get a full sense of all of these social resources, the social capital that individuals have to draw upon in their daily lives that are going to be really crucial for their, you know, for furthering their goals and their life. And from that, I can create a network of these villages that shows the position of individuals within the community. It essentially gives me a concrete measure of the social structure of these villages and the position of the individual within that. So then what I'm doing is combining in some complicated statistics, information on people's religious practice, the nature of their religious practice, and their reputational standing, and their social capital, the social support that they have to draw upon. So I can look to see what impact people's religious action has on how they're perceived by their peers, and more importantly, how their peers actually relate to them. So what I found is that people who are more involved in the religious life of the village, those people who worship regularly, and those people who are doing greater and costlier, more dramatic ritual acts, are not only seen as more devout, makes a lot of sense that people who are more religious, who are doing more religious stuff, are seen as religious, as devout. But more importantly, there's another suite of sort of pro-social qualities that that is associated with greater and costlier religious action, worship and ritual, public ritual action. So they're also seen as more hardworking, as more generous, as having better character, even as giving good advice to anyone who might ask it of them. So these qualities are being sort of discerned from the religious actions of individuals, even after having controlled for any number of other qualities that might be shaping how an individual is perceived. So it suggests that individuals are trying to pull information from the religious action that they observe of one another, and are perceiving qualities of these individuals in part through that. What's maybe more consequential, though, is it's not just a question of perception. If you then look at the social network data, I can show that people are more likely to go to someone for support, and support of any kind, whether it's financial or running errands or just sort of conversation partners. You're more likely to go to someone for support if they worship regularly and if they do greater and costlier religious action. So there's a way in which people are actually seeing those people as more generous, as more likely to assist them.
Yeah, and you have a really...
Further, it's not just religious individuals being burdened with all these requests for help and assistance from others. They're also better able to draw upon support themselves. Yeah. So they're more likely to have reciprocal relationships with their peers. So people who are doing more in the religious life of the village, whether Catholic, Protestant, or Hindu, are getting some sort of social return to that in terms of their reputational standing and their social capital.
And you do a really neat job statistically, but using this other tool, network theory and mapping. We can't show that on our podcast here because it's audio format. Maybe we'll put up a picture or two on our Facebook or Twitter pages to show folks what it's like. But it really does illustrate this. You can see the lines connecting different people and the big dots. You have big orange dots and big blue dots according to the type of religion. And it's quite amazing what you've done, and the fact that you've done this for 2 years. I think this is a project that really needed these 2 years, and so it's just the heroic effort that goes into this, and the amount of stuff that you find from this is really cool. We're gonna, you know, this will be a book at some point in time. We'll point people back to that, but really, really, really interesting research here. Speaking of Hindus and Christians, or Hindus, Catholics, and Protestants, I guess are the three major divisions that you looked at. Were there any differences across those faith traditions, or were they all pretty much the same when it came to ritualistic behavior and being trusted in the community?
So there certainly are some distinctions there. They're fine distinctions, though. So if you think about it this way, in the Christian denomination, Christian Protestant, pretty much everyone is going to church on a Sunday. So it doesn't give you much ability to discriminate between individuals when basically everyone's doing it. Relatively fewer individuals, though, are going on pilgrimages, doing these sort of public ritual actions. Those are the things that are sort of over and above. So for the Christian communities, it actually ends up being those individuals who are not only worshiping regularly, but also doing these big, more dramatic acts of going on pilgrimages and the rest that provides you a little bit more ability to discriminate, and so more insight into their sort of character and cooperative intentions. In the Hindu setting, especially in one of the villages that I worked in where most people don't have a temple that has a regular worship that they could go attend, or, you know, people just don't go and visit the temple regularly. What's actually common there is public ritual acts, is, you know, doing some act at a festival, whether it's, carrying a pot of milk or a fire pot or doing fire walking and the rest. Most people are doing some sort of public ritual act over the course of the year. Relatively fewer individuals in those settings, in the Hindu setting, are worshiping consistently each week at a temple. So it's the reverse in that setting, where then you actually seem to be getting more information from whether or not someone is worshiping regularly than from those big acts. So it's a question of sort of the balance of the two. Now, the other element here is possession, which is limited to the Hindu community. Possession seems to be doing something else entirely. So possession is certainly strongly associated with a reputation for devotion. It has the largest effect of any of the reputational or any of the sort of types of religious action on your reputation for being devout. But for almost every other quality, every other reputational quality, possession has a negligible or even negative effect on your reputational standing. And when it comes to the social support relationships, people are sometimes even actually less likely to go to you for support if you get possessed. So possession is a category in and of itself that seems to be particular to the Hindu community and is doesn't sort of fit this the pattern that you see with the other types of religious action.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because that was the one thing that tended to stick out a little bit tangentially from your analysis, is this issue of possession. Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by that? Well, I mean, what did you get a chance to see this? What does it look like? I mean, we all seen The Exorcist, I guess, or at least many of us have seen The Exorcist. So that's what we kind of think of, Linda Blair spewing pea soup and her head turning around. But I mean, I guess I've never seen this in person. What does it look like?
Mm-hmm. Right. So, there are a few different types of possession here, so it gets a little complicated. Generally, though, I can, well, okay, let me run you through the different types here and specify which I mean in particular. So the bit that's closest to the exorcist is a type of possession where what is possessing you is not a god, but some sort of spirit. It's the Tamil word is pei. It means sort of ghost or spirit. And that, you don't want to be possessed by one of these ghosts or sort of trickster spirits. That's something that does actually usually end up requiring an exorcism of some form. So people in that sense, it's usually seen as some, you know, it's unfortunate that this has happened to you, and it's something that, that you know, you need to get removed from you. It's very rare that it happens. It usually can sort of explain inexplicable behavior. Medical anthropologists and psychological anthropologists have studied the patterns of this form of possession and have found that, and this holds for India as well, it's often particularly young, recently married women who are getting possessed in this form. So when someone gets possessed like this, they'll often the spirit will sometimes start speaking through them. And you have to placate that spirit in order to get them out. You know, if they start demanding things of you, you might have to placate them a bit just in order to get that spirit removed. So if you are a, to some extent, sort of disenfranchised woman, you know, suddenly living with your in-laws when no one is really listening to you and taking your desires and wants into, you know, into account, well, you know, if you get possessed by a spirit, they're suddenly going to be listening to you a little bit more often. That I've only seen a few times. I have seen some exorcism rituals to try to remove those spirits from people, but that's really not what I'm talking about here. There are other forms of possession where what is possessing you is really a god, and it's really most often the sort of raw energy. The word is shakti. It's the like the feminine power of the god that can come and inhabit your body. And that is a desirable thing. For your body to be a worthy vessel for a god is to speak highly of you and your bhakti, your ardent love for the divine. There's still two forms there. So some people have a sort of inherited role where a particular god will come enter their body, and they can sometimes have the god speak through them, and they can impart advice and guidance to people while the god occupies their body. The more common one, and the one that I really have records of, is just when it's sort of the raw energy of the god in someone's being. So they'll sort of be flailing around, or barely able to control that energy as it courses through your body. It's usually pretty short-lived, only a few minutes. It often happens at temples, so when the god is really occupying the temple, it can sort of spread out into individuals. And if there's a lot of sort of intense worship and devotion happening, then it can almost sort of spread as a wave through the crowd. You can suddenly have a lot of people possessed by the God.
Is that a little bit like the Pentecostal speaking in tongues?
A little bit, but there's no speaking in tongues. No glossalia here. People are usually silent. Their eyes are often sort of wide and glaring. Their teeth are sometimes bared. Their arms are usually above their head, sort of flailing around, and people will be almost sort of dancing. Hmm. But it's a private thing to some extent. I mean, it's happening often collectively, but each individual is having their own experience there. And as people understand it, the person whose body it is there is no longer really present then. If you want to talk about who the relevant sort of agent is in that situation, it is the God. So people don't usually remember the experience. And return after finally having had the God left their body, either of the God's own accord, or sometimes if it gets really intense, a priest will go around and sort of calm people, put some sacred ash on their forehead to help them sort of return to the presence. Mm-hmm. So in those situations, I think part of the reason that possession doesn't work so much as a communicative act, as a signal, is because the agent there, if you're going to be discerning something about an individual when they're possessed, that individual that you're learning something about is not the person whose body it is, but the God, right? That is how people understand it. Emma Cohen is a psychological anthropologist who's done some nice studies cross-culturally and has found that people's understanding of possession is that the person whose body it is no longer present. You know, the actor, the person in the mind there, the person controlling is the spirit or the God. And that certainly is how it's understood here. So if you're looking to learn something about a person's character, you can't really do that when they're possessed, when the actor there is not that person, but some divine entity. So all you can learn is that this person is a worthy vessel, that this person is truly a strong believer, has a lot of bhakti, so you can learn something about their devotion, but nothing else. So I think that's why it's sort of an absent effect in a lot of my statistical analyses, because it's just not informative in the same way as these other more sort of active, cognizant religious action that people are carrying out.
Yeah, the ones that occur in the temple don't seem as costly if they only last for a minute or two. So, yeah,
right.
I can see how
so it's costly in that it's like you completely lose your composure. In India, sort of holding comportment is an important thing, especially for women. It's often women who are getting possessed. And once you've been flailing around for a few minutes, you know, your hair is a mess. Your sari might even be starting to fall down. I mean, it's, in that sense, it's certainly socially risky. Also because people aren't sure in some situations, is this a god or is this one of these sort of trickster spirits? So people can be very skeptical of the action. So it's socially risky, but in other ways it doesn't have the sort of standard markers of cost like the other actions do.
Fascinating stuff. I think that the issue of possession really kind of sticks out and gives you a whole other direction in the research agenda. So just absolutely fascinating results. Let me close up with this final question here. And I like to ask this of all my guests, just have them reflect upon their time doing research. And you spent a lot of time in the field, 2 years out there, and then also coming back to the States and writing this and presenting it. Over the course of that time, has there been anything that has really surprised you or has made you rethink the way you view the world?
In terms of sort of, you know, doing anthropological field work, doing ethnography, one thing that really always struck me over the course of field work was how the sort of daily concerns of people, whether you're in Santa Fe, New Mexico, or Seattle, or, rural South India, they're pretty much all the same. There's, you know, while we often are struck by the differences across cultures, when you just sort of settle into regular life, what I always found is, you know, people are worried about the same things. You know, you're worried about your kid's education, you're worried about their sort of life prospects, you're worried about that person who might be gossiping about you, you know. you're worried about these sort of, you know, these the concerns that people have are really common cross-culturally. So I think that's always, you know, there wasn't anything particularly odd or strange about where I worked. It was really the commonalities that struck me. That being said, in terms of my research, one thing that surprised me a bit that I didn't necessarily anticipate going in is, you know, you see all of these big, impressive acts that people are carrying out, you know, piercing their bodies with spears, you know, risking severe burns, walking across the bed of hot coals, things like that. You would think that what is the most salient risk there is the physical one. But actually, when you talk with people about them, what they're most worried about is not the physical risk, but the social risk. They're worried about what happens if something goes wrong and what will happen to them and their reputation, their standing, if suddenly they're put in a bad light. So people are worried not that they'll fall across the coals, but they'll do that, and then people will start gossiping. They'll start asking, why did this person fall across the hot coals? Ah, it must be because of some moral failing in their family. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be the social risks and the social consequences of that act rather than the physical risks that really preoccupy people. You know, your burns will heal, but a tarnished reputation is a lot harder to build back up. So while the focus and what sort of draws our attention to these acts in the first place is that physical demand, the physical cost, the monetary cost, all of these things that are so apparent, what actually draws people's worry and preoccupies them when they're considering undertaking these acts is actually just that little risk, that 1% risk that something might go wrong, and that, you know, the socially this could be catastrophic for them. So I think that's just an important point. It's also one that puts the costliness of these acts in a different perspective and maybe brings it back to sort of cross-cultural comparative stuff where you can think of equivalent acts, certainly in any, you know, Western middle school around the world where people are worried about, you know, that one little time they might trip a little bit, and, you know, everybody's going to be laughing at them and talking about them to certain other you know, comparisons in religious settings as well.
And there's our mascot, Rocky J. Barking, signaling to me that it's time to wrap up here. But that last interesting insight that you had was it reminds me of my 16-year-old son in high school right now, where exactly. That reputation stuff really matters. My guest today has been Eleanor Power. Ellie, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.